Next on Maine Calling, the housing crisis. How did we get here? Here on Maine Calling, we are a year into our special series, The Cost of Living, Maine's Housing Shortage. We've examined the housing crisis in Maine from many perspectives and will continue to do so in 2025. Today, we're zooming out and looking at the big picture. What are the root causes of the housing crisis, both in Maine and nationwide? Are there big systemic things that need to change to fix it? Are we making enough progress? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, the 50,000-foot view. Like so many challenging problems, the housing crisis is complicated, but many people believe it doesn't have to be so hard. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we continue our series, The Cost of Living, Maine's Housing Shortage. For a year now, we've been looking at different facets of this crisis. Today, we'll take a broader view, plus learn what some different communities are doing to address it. Joining me right now, Dean Baker, a senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research, and Greg Payne, senior advisor on housing policy with the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation and the Future. We invite you to join the conversation as always. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Dean, welcome to Maine Calling, and Greg, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Dean Baker, I'm going to start with you because we've had a lot of discussions over the last year about all sorts of things, whether it's zoning in different Maine cities, the role of short-term rentals, the number of people who've moved to Maine recently. But I don't want to have our audience have a sense that this is just a Maine problem. This is a big national problem, and it's got deep roots, that all over the country there are places that don't have enough housing by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of homes. So let's start. My understanding, and I'm going to have you correct me if I'm wrong, that the roots of the housing crisis probably go back to the Reagan administration in the early 1980s when the government stopped building housing and then exacerbated by the recession between 2007 and 2009. And then the kind of things like people moving, millennials being a big generation, things like that, those are sort of the most recent layer of the problem. Would you agree with that summary?
Largely, but there's some different issues involved here. So what happened in the Reagan era was that we had various federal supports for housing, including direct building of housing, but also Section 8 vouchers, that's a subsidy for rental assistance for low, moderate income people. And he cut those back hugely. I think they cut back building, direct building altogether. I'd have to double check on that one. But in any case, it's gone through the floor. So if the federal government's still building any housing or funding any housing, it's directed housing. It's very, very low. So that created a crisis at, say, the lower end. You know, it's the bottom quarter of people in the housing market. So we definitely reduced the supply of affordable units beginning under Reagan. Then we had the housing bubble in the late 90s, first years of this century, and we were building like crazy. We had been building, if you go back to the early 90s, we could argue when we should say the bubble started, doesn't matter, but say around 1.4 million units a year, that seemed to be roughly keeping in pace with demand. We began to build much more rapidly at the end of the decade and into the zeros. And we peaked at about 2.1, 2.2 million, 2004, 2005. And then we had the collapse of the bubble in 2008, 2009, and construction went through the floor. So we were only building at the low point. I think it was around 800,000 units in 2009. I believe that was the low point. We gradually started to increase, but it was very slow. So we continued to have gross underbuilding 2010, 11, 12. We were finally at the start of the pandemic, we're up around 1.3 million units. Maybe that was keeping pace with demand. Again, we could sit down and have a debate what exactly would keep pace with demand. That was getting close, probably still a little low. Then we get hit with the pandemic, and it actually had a surge in construction, because what we saw with the pandemic was there was a massive increase in demand for housing for the simple reason we had a huge increase in work from home. So you had all these people that they said, oh, I need extra space at home, and they could afford it because they saved on commuting costs. They didn't have to pay for drive into the city. They didn't have to, you know, have office clothes that they get cleaned. So they were able to get bigger housing and they could move further away. So you had a lot of people moving on to the suburbs, a lot of people moving to smaller towns. If they could work completely remotely, you could live anywhere. So that led to a huge increase in both house prices and rents in 2021, 22 into 23. So as it stands now, rents are about 25-26%, I'm speaking nationally, higher than they were before the pandemic. Sale prices are about 50% higher. So we saw a huge increase in prices. Now that has started to level off and maybe even decline in many places, particularly home prices. We are seeing places where you see a decline. But the roots of it, again, you're right on the, you know, if we look at the lower end, I shouldn't say lower end, lower quarter or so of the labor market, that goes back to the Reagan era. We cut back federal supports. But more generally, we do have a shortage of housing that was due most immediately to the huge underbuilding following the collapse of the bubble. But then also it's aggravated, you know, as I'm sure you know, you've been doing this by zoning restrictions that make it very difficult to build in many areas. So a lot of moving parts here, but long and short, we need more housing.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, a number that we're hearing a lot in Maine, because Greg's office did a study a couple of years ago, is that 80,000 homes need to be built, housing units need to be built in Maine in the near term future to keep up with demand. What is the national shortage? How many housing units is the country short right now?
That's, I mean, you get numbers all over the place. I saw on someone on one of the social media sites was circulating a study that had a number of 20 million. I think that's a little far-fetched, but I would put the range somewhere between 3 and 5 million. So that's a lot of units. We're not going to make it up in a year. You know, if we could make it up in 10 years, that would be really good. I mean, you know, we could try to be more ambitious and we should. But, you know, if you made that up in 10 years, that would be a really good story. So that would mean, you know, again, I don't, you know, God hasn't told me what the correct number is that is just justified by the growth in demand. But let's say it's somewhere around 1.3, 1.4 million. If we could build around 1.8, 1.9 million, that would be great. That's a year, you know, an annual rate. So, you know, in 5, 6, 7 years, that would make a really big dent. And I should point out, we got up to that. We were building about 1.8 million units 2021 into 22. Then we had the jump in interest rates and construction just plummeted. I shouldn't say plummeted, but it fell off sharply after the Fed began to raise interest rates in March of 2022.
All right, Greg, I'm going to turn to you. On top of all these sort of national variables, what is happening here in Maine that is exacerbating the housing crisis?
Yeah, I mean, first, Jennifer, thanks for the invitation to come back. And thank you for all the conversations that you've been hosting around housing over the past year. I think it's been a really great opportunity for people to speak to what's on their mind with this kind of top tier issue that people are struggling with. I completely agree with everything that Dean said and your characterization that what we're seeing in Maine is a reflection of what's happening across the nation. I think one of the things I would add that is specific to Maine and some other states is the fact that we're experiencing in-migration. And that's a wonderful thing for our long-term economy, but it's certainly creating some additional short-term challenges for us in the sense that, you know, if housing production is not increasing in a really significant way at the same time that a significant number of additional households are moving to Maine because they think it's a wonderful place to be. You know, obviously it's like a giant game of musical chairs where there's more people and about the same number of chairs. And that is part of why we're experiencing the problem we have right now.
All right. And Greg, why don't you bring us up to speed? I know that you have really been working hard around the state to find financing for more development. Where are we? How many new housing units came online in 2024, and what's expected for 2025 here in Maine?
Well, the answer is unfortunately a little more complicated than I wish. In terms of affordable housing development, those are numbers that we can count because Maine State Housing Authority is involved with all of that, and they're really great partners. And we can see from numbers that in terms of the affordable units we're adding each year, we used to be around 225 units a year of affordable housing being added to our stock. And now we're getting up closer to about 750 affordable units a year. That's progress. Obviously, when you're talking about the thousands and thousands of units we're short, it's not enough progress. When you're talking about how much housing the state is creating beyond those specifically affordable units, meaning they have a long-term affordability covenant, that's where it gets a little harder because right now the main way that information is collected about building permits is through the US Census. And frankly, the numbers are highly unreliable. So, one of the things that was called out in that report that you mentioned earlier, that cited the need for about 80,000 new units, by 2030, one of the things that was also called out is that we need a system in Maine to help track our progress because relying on those census numbers, simply doesn't cut it. So, I think that's a conversation you're going to see happening in the coming legislative session. Is how we can work with municipalities to get reliable information from them about building permits, demo permits, certificates of occupancy to better answer that question and see how we're progressing.
All right. Dean, while we're having this 50,000 foot conversation, I need to ask you, why is housing so expensive? We hear it's because construction costs have gone up, that materials are more expensive, that labor costs are higher. How much of this, though, is bureaucratic costs? How much of the, I don't know if you can put a number on it, but is that a significant part of the problem that it costs so much for a developer to bring something new on the market?
It is, but I mean, part of the story, or at least, I guess I would frame it this way, is you want to ask how much has that increased? So, I hear have discussions with people and they go, oh, there's all these, bureaucratic obstacles, this and that. Go, okay, but weren't there bureaucratic obstacles 20 years ago? Now, that doesn't mean that we don't want to get rid of them, but I just think we have to be careful if we're saying, oh, look how much prices have gone up. So let's say we're talking about the period since the pandemic, about 5 years now. How much of that was due to bureaucratic processes? I'd say probably very, very little, because I really doubt there are many places where the bureaucracy is notably worse in 225 than it was in 219. So again, it is an obstacle, it is a cost. Is that the reason prices have risen a lot? I'd have to say probably not. I think most of the story was you simply had increased demand that outstrip the supply. I mean, one thing about housing that distinguishes it from we want to buy more TVs or more cars, if everyone ran out and bought TVs and cars tomorrow, okay, that the price will go up a lot. But over the span of 6 months a year, we could produce as many cars and TVs as people want to buy. That wasn't true during the pandemic. I'll just note that we had supply chain issues, but during normal times, housing, that's not true. It takes time to build houses. There's zoning rules, there's all sorts of, you have to plan this and that. So if we're asking how much of the price increase was due to bureaucratic processes, I'd say if we're talking the last 5 years or so, very, very little, if any. Over a longer term, how much can we point to them driving up the cost? It's substantial. But again, one more thing, there was a good piece in the New York Times a few days ago where people were saying, oh, government bureaucracy, we have to cut regulation. And it focused on, it was actually a representative in the neighboring area of me. She said she was complaining about all the regulations around daycare, that if they want to serve fresh fruit, they would have to add like five sinks. And of course, that'd be very expensive for a small daycare center. Well, what the person writing the piece was pointing out, well, do you want them washing fruit in the same sink that little kids are going to the bathroom, and they're washing, that's probably not a good idea. So the point, that's a little far afield, is the point is most of these regulations do actually have a purpose. So that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to pare them back. You have to look at them with a critical eye. You have to say sometimes, okay, maybe it would be ideal to have two fire escapes, but one would probably be sufficient in almost all cases. I'm pulling that again out of the air, but that's the sort of thing when we're getting into the regulation, you can't just say, oh, we're going to get rid of it all. That would
Right.
not work. What you have to do is look at it very critically and say, where can we pare it back?
Greg, what do you hear from developers who are working to in here in Maine?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those issues do come up, certainly. I will say, big picture, I think the single biggest driver of this real significant increase in cost in recent years is the lack of labor in some of the trades. I think that is the single biggest reason why here in Maine prices have gone up to build housing as much as they have. But again, there's a lot to it. I do think that some of the processes, regulations, rules that developers have to follow do create serious delay and can increase cost. And you know, maybe this is something we're going to get into over the course of this hour, but identifying all those state level levers that we can and looking closely at each of them and seeing which ones we can pull to reduce cost and increase efficiency. That is what I think we'll be focusing on a great deal in the coming legislative session.
All right. Well, we do need to take a quick break. Already, so many calls coming in. We're also going to hear from folks focused on bringing new housing to Portland and Bangor in the next part of the program. We are talking about Maine's affordable housing crisis on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're discussing what might be in store for the Maine housing crisis in the year ahead and also the bigger picture here. My guest, Greg Payne, Senior Advisor on Housing Policy with the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation and the Future, and Dean Baker, a Senior Economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research. He studies this issue on the national level. We invite you to join the conversation. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Peter Van Allen, who is the editor of Maine Biz. And Peter, it's interesting to me, your colleague Carol was on the program yesterday talking about the linkage between the affordable housing crisis and the workforce crisis, that companies can't hire people if they don't have somewhere to live. But I also know that you've been talking with many developers about what they need to develop more housing in Maine, and I'm wondering what you're hearing from them.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Jennifer, thanks for having me on, first of all. It's a hot topic for us at Maine Biz, but it's a hot topic in Maine in general. And as you pointed out, and as your earlier panelists have said, I mean, it's all connected to the overall shortage of housing. If, you know, if there's pressure on the high end of houses, I mean, we have to go back. I mean, even just a couple of years before the pandemic, the median home price in Maine was around 200,000, and it's almost double that. I mean, it's around, it was, I think, 385,000. It went up over 400,000. So there's a lot of pressure from all directions. If people can't find homes, they can't accept a job here, and that affects everything from restaurants to law firms, and it's all kind of wrapped up. To answer your question, I think developers are, I now that I think the luxury market is kind of slowing down a bit, it was always easier for developers to go in and do market rate housing or luxury housing. It's just a bit more of a profit margin. I think now that that market is starting to slow down a bit, you might see more developers kind of pushing toward affordable housing because the need is there. It's clear the need is there.
All right. Where do you see development going?
Well, I mean, I think this is a topic that's going to come up over the course of this hour. I mean, developers tend to go where the path of least resistance, I think, a lot of times. And I think it'll probably be a topic that comes up a fair amount in this hour, you know, that developers get frustrated sometimes in Portland, and they look to markets like Biddeford, Lewiston, and now Bath. I think that's part of it. But I think there is still development going on in Portland, and there's still real need in Portland. I think a lot of times developers look for places where a city comes to them and they say, we have this plot of land, or we have this old building that could be converted to housing. You know, we'll help pave the way. We'll help kind of clear the red tape. The zoning is already in place. We have a tax increment financing program that you can take advantage of. So they're making it easier for developers, let's say, than you know, in some places where the path of resistance is a little bit more difficult.
All right. Well, Kevin, I appreciate your perspective. Excuse me, Peter, I appreciate your perspective. We have Kevin Kraft next. Peter Van Allen is editor of Maine Biz. And indeed, turning to Kevin Kraft with the City of Portland. Kevin, you just heard what Peter had to say. We've heard others say that it's difficult to develop in Portland. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, first off, thanks for having me, Jennifer. And obviously, I'm biased. And I'd say I think we're very pro-development city, and I think, as many folks may know, in November, the City Council adopted our RECODE initiative, and that was Portland's first comprehensive rewrite of our entire land use code and zoning map in over 50 years, and that really took a critical look at all of our rules and regulations for how we develop our land, and ultimately, the goal there was to eliminate those barriers and create opportunities. So, you know, thinking about the changes we made as part of that, we, you know, the city allows up to 2 accessory dwelling units on any residential property throughout the city. We significantly expanded housing choices, so we still allow single family homes for certain, but we also allow 4 to 10 dwelling units on any property throughout the city. So that's, you know, downtown all the way out to North Deering. And then a big aspect of RECODE was we actually eliminated density requirements and we increased building heights in all of our mixed-use zones throughout the city. So these are areas that are commercial, they're mixed-use, they have great access to transit, and we really wanted to make sure that we were encouraging infill development, and we eliminated historical barriers to development in those areas by, you know, getting rid of density altogether to say we want to see more multifamily in these areas to make it more bustling and vibrant and create more opportunities.
And Kevin, have you seen, has this moved the needle yet? Have you seen a response?
Yeah, certainly. So it was adopted in November. The code actually went into effect in early December, and we've already seen a significant number of increases in our pre-application meetings. So that is a meeting that's held before an applicant actually submits an application. So as soon as that was adopted, all of those meetings have been filled throughout the past 2 months, and we're just starting to see the first applications roll in now that RECODE's actually been put in place. So, you know, the fact that we eliminated so many of those administrative burdens that other folks have already touched on, we think is really going to help continue to incentivize the development that we're seeing in the city. For instance, one thing folks talk about a lot is about the office market and conversion to office space. So one thing we did in RECODE was to say, well, if there's an office space that's underdeveloped and it's converting to residential, we don't need to review that. Our planning board doesn't need to review that. So that doesn't even come through the planning department anymore. That goes right to a building permit and allows you to skip that administrative burden that many people see, again, to try to incentivize housing in the areas that we want to see it be created.
And great, Kevin, before I let you go, I want to ask you, does the City of Portland have a goal? Do you have a number of new homes you'd like to see developed by a certain date?
Certainly. The Comprehensive Plan of Portland, it was adopted in 2017. It did have a number at that time. It was roughly 2,000 units, and we surpassed that number easily. And it was a relatively low number, but again, you have to remember that was at a different time, and it was factoring in the jobs at job demand at the moment. But we did significantly surpass that. And I think the goal for Portland, it's not so much a number, but it's making sure that we are encouraging development. We're a development-friendly city, but in the right places. So again, making sure that we're encouraging infill development, not supporting sprawl, and making sure that folks can live a sustainable lifestyle. And I think we've seen that over the years. We had, you know, as much as the challenges of development in Portland people share, you know, in 2021, we approved 980 new homes. In 2023, we approved over 1,200 new homes. And in 2024, we approved over 450 new homes. So now that RECODE's in place, we're just expecting those numbers to increase significantly this year.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining the conversation. Kevin Kraft, the Director of Planning and Urban Development in the City of Portland. And I'm wondering, Dean, as you listen to what Kevin has said and you compare it to what's going on in other small cities around the country, is that the right track, the kind of changes that have been made in the code there?
Yeah, I mean, that really sounds fantastic to me. If I had a checklist, they got almost everything on it. I mean, you obviously have to see how everything plays out in practice, but, you know, they hit the right things. Again, it's always, you always run into obstacles that when you, you know, when the rubber hits the road, you maybe didn't anticipate or you knew it was going to be a problem, but make it more difficult. But this is exactly what you want to see. And yeah, I hope it turns out. I mean, it sounds like things are going well there. I've been to Portland. It's a beautiful place. So I can understand a lot of people wanting to live there. So yeah, it sounds like they're going the right way. I just want to jump back quickly on something Greg said about labor costs, because this is something, again, it's just a win-win to my mind. We have shortages in the construction trades, the skilled trades, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, on down the list. And increasing, you have union apprenticeship programs, many areas, those could be expanded. Community colleges, people can get the skills there in many cases. It's a great win-win because these are good paying jobs. So you'll get workers, you'll get good paying jobs for workers who might otherwise not have those options. It allows for more building. It really is something that, you know, government should be looking to promote as much as possible. I should also point out these trades, even though it's not as bad as it was the case when, you know, I was growing up, they're still overwhelmingly male. So making them more friendly to women. I know we have, you know, the crusade against DEI and all this, but look, women don't feel comfortable in a lot of these trades. It's really important that they should feel, a woman should feel as comfortable becoming a carpenter and a plumber as a man does. That would be a big improvement. Do you want to call that DEI and call it that? But that's just, to my view, common sense.
And to that point, Greg, I know that I probably did my first story on trying to recruit more women to trades in Maine a quarter century ago. This has been a big effort for a long time.
Yes, it has. And I wholeheartedly agree. And the governor had issued an executive order around those issues just in the last few months in welcoming women into the construction trades and doing all we can to promote that. I do also just want to say before we leave it completely, how helpful and important the work is that has been done in Portland with that RECODE effort. Kevin and Nell Donaldson and their colleagues and the city of Portland did a bang up job on RECODE. They did it the right way. It took a long time, but it is now the current set of ordinances in Portland. And I think the next stage, now that they've cleared the way for people to add additional housing units, if they choose, is for people to become more aware of that. I think residents of Portland probably are not fully aware of the additional rights they now have to build an ADU or other units on the property that they own. So I think that's the next stage of this. Once people understand that, I think they'll be utilizing the new rights that Portland has authorized.
All right, from Portland to Bangor, calling in now Ann Krieg, who is Director of the Department of Community and Economic Development for the City of Bangor. Hi, Ann, thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us what the Bangor City Council has done to remove barriers to building new housing.
Yeah, the City Council continues to direct us to remove those barriers. We, as an example that was talked about earlier in your program about communities, you know, reaching out to developers, we've done that. We're working with Developers Collaborative to build up to 75 units of middle income. We're looking at that 80 to 120% of average income to, you know, for either ownership or rental on city property. So we're going to be, you know, finishing that up this year, hopefully. We also have a pilot program. One thing that we heard from people that own, you know, multifamily apartment buildings was the cost of installing sprinklers and other things to meet code requirements when they add units. So we're using our ARPA funds for assisting landlords to be able to pay for that because it's very expensive to retrofit that in. We're also finalizing with Garin Architects our pre-approved architectural plans for people that want to put in an accessory dwelling unit. We're going to have a couple of options for that, as well as some multifamily buildings to, you know, remove that cost barrier of hiring an architect to prepare plans that meet codes. So we have a lot going on.
You have a lot going on. Do you feel as though with everything going on in Bangor, Anne, that you are on pace to build what you need in the next couple of years?
We're still hearing a lot from people at both ends of the spectrum, as well as that middle income, you know, people that are making less than $35,000, you know, there's still a need for that level of affordability. But we also hear from, you know, people at the hospital that have, you know, higher income positions where they're having a hard time recruiting because they're having a hard time finding housing. So, you know, we're still looking at that full spectrum of housing stock to be able to meet those demands that are still here.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for calling in. Anne Krieg, Director of the Department of Community and Economic Development for the City of Bangor. We're going to go to Carl, who's calling from Minot. Hi, Carl. Go ahead.
Hi. I spent most of my 60 years in New Gloucester and not Minot, only recent resident of Minot. But I sold my farm for divorce reasons, but I kept about a little under 10 acres that I was going to develop. And I recall my father going to a zoning meeting in the early 1970s and coming back saying that, like, zoning is basically people who want to turn the door, lock the key, and throw the key away. And there's been decades now of people for their self-interest, whether consciously or unconsciously, put barriers in to make it more and more expensive to build. And to me, from my experience, I quickly came to the realization, instead of doing this four-lot subdivision, which realistically you don't need 2 or 5 acres, this plot of land could extremely reasonably support 7, that another developer told me just sell one lot every 5 years. So probably about the time I die, the fourth lot will be sold, as opposed to having in 4, maybe 7 lots last year. And that's because of zoning, and I could talk for 15 minutes.
That's okay. We have lots of callers coming in. Greg Payne, your response to Carl.
Well, I hear Carl's pain. This is a big problem here in Maine. It's a problem across the country. Obviously, zoning has a purpose in the big picture of helping communities to be thoughtful about the way they plan for the future. I just think that Carl is onto something in the way that that has rolled out in communities across the state, across the nation, where it becomes unnecessarily difficult for people to add even a modest amount of housing units. And that is, I think, going to be, again, a very hot topic in the coming legislative session.
Yeah, I think, you know, just jumping in on that, it is, there is a balance here. And, you know, to say no zoning, and I know people, I'm on Twitter or whatever it is now, X, and, you know, you have a lot of people will say, oh, you shouldn't have zoning at all. And I made this quip about, well, if San Francisco were as dense as Manhattan, no one would want to live there. That's an old joke. People didn't get it. But the point was, people like San Francisco because it's this really cool city that has these small town, you know, small buildings from, you know, the beginning of the 20th century. And if they built, replace them all with high rises, it wouldn't be as attractive a place. So I'm sympathetic to the idea you want to protect some things with zoning. But in many cases, probably most cases, we've gone too far. So we have to make it, you know, kind of put our thumb on the scale that it's pro-development, but recognize you still want to protect certain areas, certain things.
And sure, Greg, that is the balance here, maintaining the character of communities and the reason people want to move to Maine.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so that balancing is a really important undertaking that legislators on both sides of the aisle, I think, are going to be really anxious to get into because they're hearing the same concern, you know, not just from developers, but also from, you know, constituents who need housing and everyone needs a place to call home. And I think it's extraordinarily frustrating for people when they see something developing and then it gets killed or denied or whatever. even though it would seem to even fall within existing zoning and land use rules. That's the kind of issue I think people are struggling with, and we'll see if we can come up with some ideas that are reasonable and practical and kind of balance the equities well.
Carl, thanks for your call. We are going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are continuing our series on Maine's housing crisis. Instead of looking at one facet of this, as we have for a year now and will continue to do so, we're taking a broader look at some of the root causes of it and some of the progress that has been made or not made. Joining me, Dean Baker, who's senior economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research, a national organization, and Greg Payne with the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation and the Future. If you want to, you can try to get through. You can email us, talk@mainpublic.org, post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I am going to go here to an email from Nancy. Where I live, more and more houses are becoming second homes and Airbnbs. Comment, Greg, I know you were trying to get your hands around how big of a factor the growth in the short-term rental market has been in the housing crisis. Have you all been able to do so? There is a feeling out there that this is really a major part of the problem. We hear this every time we do a Maine Calling on housing. Is it indeed a major part of the problem?
Well, I think the answer is that it is a major part of the problem in some parts of the state. And in other parts, it's not. And in fact, the research that we've commissioned across a range of housing issues told us that when you zoom out statewide, this is not nearly as big of an issue as other things that we've been talking about. But when you zoom in on certain communities, Portland, up the Midcoast, some other places, absolutely, it is significant. And I think the fact that it is relatively localized is why there's been less action on the policy front on a statewide level, and why this is an issue that we're seeing local communities take on individually.
I got a Kitsy calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy, go ahead.
Hi. I just listened yesterday to another wonderful show on this channel, and it was about home. No place like home. And the author of the book, I can't remember the title, spoke about how much she thinks that home should be one of our human rights, and that we often talk in terms of housing units. Although I've heard many people here use the term home, which warms my heart. And she's just trying to let people remember that homes are so important to us as human beings. It's really critical for us to be able, however small, however humble, to have a place that we call home. There's no place like home.
Kitsy, thanks so much for calling in. And Dean, you're an economist. You know the numbers inside out, upside down. But this concept that having a home ought to be a human right, how important of the conversation is this?
Well, it is an important part. I mean, I think many of us find it outrageous. We have so many people who are homeless and others who have grossly inadequate housing. And we're a rich enough country that shouldn't be the case. And, we have to take that very seriously as a problem. And one of the things, I should have said something about this earlier. I think when we talk about, construction, it is important to be clear. We need to address the problem of more moderate income people. Those are the ones that end up homeless. And again, I'm not saying anything that, what we've heard before goes against that. But I mean, one of the things many places, maybe this is happening in Maine, many places have done is that they make a rule that if you're putting up a development of more than 20 units or whatever it might be, 10%, 20% of those have to be designated as moderate income housing. I think, again, you can go too far with that. You make it 40%, they won't build it. I heard of someone doing that in San Francisco and they didn't build the units. But, it's a way to try to ensure that we have housing for even those people who are lower down the income ladder, working, people with disabilities maybe can't work, or people working in low-paying jobs. We really have to make it so everyone has a place they could live in. And we used to do a much better job of that. So it's not just saying, oh, pie in the sky. We used to do a much better job. I'm not going to idealize the world 50 years ago, because in a lot of cases, it wasn't, you know, one we'd be happy with today. But we did do a better job in housing more moderate income people than we're doing today.
Kitsy, thanks for your comment. We're going to go to Oriana calling from Augusta. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My name is Oriana. I'm an attorney at Maine Equal Justice, and I appreciate the conversation today about building affordable housing. I have a question about shorter-term solutions for my clients. I represent Mainers who are facing eviction. I've helped a lot of people apply for the new eviction prevention program from Maine Housing, which is helping a lot of low-income renters in Maine with a very high cost of rent and is making a huge difference in my clients' lives. And you know, I've been working with low-income tenants in Maine for a lot of years, and as the guests, I think Dean pointed out, since the pandemic, high rents in Maine are driving a lot of evictions that I work on. My clients who are essential workers in Maine, like seafood processors and in-home care workers, are spending so much more and more of their income every year trying to keep up with the rent. And so I'm wondering, while we work on building more homes, which is going to take years, and like maybe my clients, I hope my clients' kids will benefit from affordable housing development in Maine. Programs like the Eviction Prevention Program have been an incredible step towards stability for my clients and people all over the state, with a focus on people with low incomes who I think are facing the greatest need in this housing crisis. And so knowing that there was so much unmet need with the Eviction Prevention Program, how do your guests see rental assistance fitting in as a housing solution for Maine, especially as a short-term or interim solution as we hope to build more affordable housing for the future?
Greg.
Yeah, it's a really, really good point. Rental assistance is utterly necessary, especially for people below a certain income threshold, say 30% of area median income and below. And the reason for that is because you can't really build housing for folks with lower incomes than that and expect them to be able to afford the rents that you have to charge because of what you've borrowed for development costs. So, you know, rental assistance is primarily provided through the federal government through the Section 8 program. It works incredibly well. I think Oriana would probably agree there's not enough of it. One of the challenges that we have in the state of Maine is replicating something like a Section 8 at the state level, simply because our revenues are more challenging. We're not a high revenue state. And once you start, you need to keep up that kind of expenditure. The eviction prevention pilot that was passed earlier, was passed last year, I think has given a lot of people opportunities to remain in their homes, and we ought to learn from that. But I think in the immediate short term, kind of looking forward, I think we're holding our breath at the federal budget and what's going to happen with the Housing Choice Voucher program in the new administration.
Dean, anything to add to that?
I'd very much agree with the Section 8 program has been a great success to my view. Unfortunately, I think it is in political jeopardy, as Greg had said. We'll have to see how that pans out with the new administration, but it's done what it was supposed to. If anything, I'd like to see it expanded. I don't think the administration necessarily cares what I think in that respect. But again, it's been a good program insofar as the state could kick in to expand it to support people in Maine. That would be a great thing to do.
Oriana, thanks for your call. We'll go up to Brewer and Colleen. Hi, Colleen. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I love your program, and this is especially current. But I have a question for your panel about, I'm sure I'm not the only senior citizen on a fixed income who's got a big house that they know if they sell their house, they have really no place practical to go. I don't see builders building like a senior communities that are less than, you know, $400,000 or $500,000. So I'd like to see more of that kind of building, and I'd like your panel to, does anybody have any suggestions on how that can happen?
Colleen, I really appreciate your call. What I'm thinking about the calls that are coming in is that each of you, one by one, are addressing some of those issues that we either have or will be addressing as part of this series and expanding upon them. But Greg, this is a major issue in Maine, that there is not enough senior housing. And doesn't that cause a bit of a lockup in the market when people like Colleen can't move out of their big homes that could be a family home because they don't have anywhere to go?
It sure is. I mean, you know, challenges for older Mainers in affording their housing has only been increasing. And this is why there's been a good number of affordable projects that have been financed in the last 6-7 years that specifically are focused on providing housing for older Mainers. Big picture, yeah, you could sell your home and you might even get a pretty good value for it. But the question is, where are you going to go? And I think it just sort of speaks to our need to make sure we're creating all the housing we can and pulling all the levers we can to push along the production pipeline.
Let's throw in one more thing there with, because I agree very much with serious problems, especially with aging baby boomers increasingly. Well, they're all in their 60s and 70s now. Many of them will be looking to downsize. There's a lot of confusion about our tax code. I'm an economist, so I get caught up in these things. But I don't know how many people I've talked to say, oh, I'd love to sell my home, but I'd have to, pay it all in taxes. And we have actually incredibly generous tax treatment. I have no idea what the Trump administration will do on this, but we have incredibly generous tax treatment on capital gains from selling a house. You have something like $450,000. That's not an exact number, but $450,000 in capital gains that goes altogether untaxed on a home that you've been living in for two of the last 5 years. So that's $450,000 free and clear. I've had people go, oh, but I have $500,000. Well, you made a lot of money if you do, but you're only paying tax on $50,000, not on the $500,000. So I'm just saying this because I think it's really unfortunate because people aren't doing something that would be good for them and, of course, good for society. You're freeing up a house that a family could live in. You know, if it's one person or a couple that you had the big house, you raised your family, and yeah, you'd rather move on. Someone else would rather be in there. We just need, if people were just better informed, we could get at least free up some housing that way.
Thank you so much for your comment, Colleen. From Cynthia, an email: in all the discussions and editorials on the subject, I have yet to hear one word about the real underlying cause of unaffordable renting housing. It is simply landlord greed. Costs to operate rental units have not increased enough to match the enormous increases in rents. Landlords point to supply and demand as their license to gouge. Why is this aspect never discussed? Greg, you want to respond to Cynthia?
Yeah, I mean, that's a this is a really hard issue. I mean, this is obviously we live in a marketplace that needs regulation. I think there's always a balancing that then has to happen about how much you regulate the ability of landlords to raise rents. And, that you have to obviously factor in the fact that costs are up. Insurance is up and real estate taxes are up and operating costs are up. And so, it's fair that landlords would need to raise their rents to keep up with their own costs. I think the emailer is probably onto something, that there are plenty of landlords who go above and beyond that. And I think, for state lawmakers, the challenge is how deep do you reach into the market to regulate that activity? Knowing that we're talking about somebody's home. And there are some actions that the state legislature took in the 131st legislature to deal with this a little bit and to help give people more notice and to try to prevent more people from being evicted. But I certainly understand the frustration that I think she's voicing in that email.
And Dean, just about a minute left, a huge issue, whether or not there ought to be rent control.
Yeah, I'm actually sympathetic to rent control where it could be administered well. There's many cases where it's been administered very poorly. And if the underlying problem is a shortage of housing, you won't create more housing with rent control. But to deal with sort of a temporary situation, say people should be secure in their housing, you don't have a landlord that just says, oh, I want to raise your rent 30% next year. I think that's a good thing. But again, it has to be done at the local level. The idea that the federal government's going to do it, I think, is close to crazy. Probably not too much better at the state level. But if you have a city, that a local area that's committed to it and prepared to deal with enforcing in a serious way and recognizing you have to raise it to cover costs, I think it can be a good way to keep people in their units, their homes.
All right. Well, I need to apologize to everybody who did not get through today, but do know that this is a series we will be continuing throughout 2025, looking at the housing crisis in Maine and beyond. And thank you both for joining us for the hour. Greg Payne, Senior Advisor on Housing Policy with the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation in the Future, and Dean Baker, Senior Economist with the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, our guest is personal finance expert Michelle Singletary. She returns to answer your questions about saving for retirement, paying off that credit card debt, and so much more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.